KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The mission of getting a bill done to strengthen America is more important than any of us clinging to a specific belief.
They are offered work, then forced to give up their wages, their papers, their freedom. This is human trafficking. Let's call an end to human trafficking.
We had a gun bazaar break out on the streets of Seattle outside of a gun buyback. I mean, that was just insane.
That was Mayor McGinn talking about the outside of the gun buyback last Saturday. You also heard a clip from a new anti-human trafficking ad that's been put out by King County. And Charles Schumer at the announcement at the bipartisan agreement reached on immigration reform by the senators, and it's not been passed, but you know, we'll be writing about it that way for a while. Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Madam.
And sir, good morning. That's the kind of respect we expect on this show.
That's right. Knut Berger is the Mossback columnist at Crosscut.com, an expert in the history of our region and author of Pugetopolis and Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Sir.
Thank you, Steve.
Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger and a Pulitzer Prize winner. Sir.
Nice to see you.
We were saying that probably we should do the show off the air because we're more coherent there.
We can't call you Hey You.
No.
Darn.
I was going to start... Well, let's start with the gun buyback just for a moment, just because it was an interesting story. Everybody, I think, covered the fact that outside the gun buyback program was a gun bazaar. And it was illegal and fascinating.
That was, okay, so legal, anybody can set up, anybody can do this. There was nothing illegal. There certainly were enough cops there to figure that out. But, you know, that was really a sort of a twist on a story. It was supposed to be all about, you know, we offered these $100 and $200 gift cards, and here's who came, and here's the number collected, and blah, blah, blah. But the story sort of had a little change to it, which was that...
Cash is very appealing.
Cash might be appealing, and just the idea that people were, you know, talking about how much more valuable some of these guns were. And what was up with the missile launcher?
That was amazing.
That was totally strange. And so that even triggered another version of the story, which was, in case you missed it, there was a missile launcher that was turned in. And so then the question was, where did that come from? Was that actually stolen? Or did somebody acquire that legally?
Didn't they say it had been used?
It had been used. So it was just the launch tube. This was a Stinger missile launcher of the type that the CIA was spending like $70,000 a launcher to buy back from Afghans, who the CIA had slipped them to when the Afghans were fighting on our side, or quote-unquote our side, against the Soviets. And how one of those turns up in Seattle at the gun buyback program going for $100 is...
And that was the most... That they actually did pay $100 for that thing, right?
Yeah.
Or $200.
But this was in the sidewalk bazaar that opened up. I don't think that the missile launcher...
Initially.
Bought with a gift card. And then I think the police took custody of it because my understanding was it's illegal to have...
It perhaps exceeds even the NRA's idea of what should be...
to show the kids.
It would be interesting to know what Wayne LaPierre says about that.
You know, again, John Stewart, who... they must have a crack team of people looking back on tape. So they were talking about the whether there should be the closing of the gun loophole, which is really about background checks for all gun sales, private sales, which was the question raised by the gun bazaar. And in 1999, Wayne LaPierre testified before Congress, and he said they supported complete background checks even at private sales. So the interesting thing is how the evolution of gun policy from the NRA has shifted so much. They've become much more...
Absolutist.
I find that fascinating.
Yeah, and so there was that juxtaposition on, as Stewart did that, he did a juxtaposition of what had been said in 1999 and what they were saying now. You know, it was really interesting if you think about this. Did everybody not notice that during the presidential campaign, you didn't even hear a peep about gun control? It was like, yeah, there's this subject, nobody bring it up. It came up, never. So it's very interesting then, just then and now, which wasn't that long ago.
You know, I think Danny Westnick criticized the gun buyback program in the Seattle Times for the gun bazaar that it opened up on the streets of Seattle. But I thought that it was a wonderful dual demonstration project. One, a demonstration of the desire on people's part to get rid of guns and the relatively cheap price for making it worth their time to go and do it. I mean, the amount of weaponry and the type of weaponry that was brought in was staggering. And you can feel the untapped market, so to speak, out there for the government buying these back. And then, you know, the rather horrifying scene that, you know, turned up on the sidewalk, I think is not a reason to not do this, which I think was Westnick's argument, if I understood it correctly, but a demonstration of why we should close this loophole. Close the loophole and keep doing gun buyback program.
There were lots of rifles that looked like they hadn't been shot in a long time or didn't work, but there were more than a few AR-15s, assault rifles that they were looking at. There were a couple of those.
Some street sweepers.
Yeah, those were
of those.
Those were very odd. Who knew that they made shotgun-based pump-action rifles?
Who knew? I know. I mean, you go down to a loan shop on...
with the whole magazine looked like an old Tommy gun, except it was...
Oh, one of those. Okay, yeah. No, I was thinking about these short little shotguns that are almost like pistols. They're shotguns, but they have a stock. And I was doing an article on guns some years ago when I was at the Weekly and went into a gun shop on First Avenue and was talking to them about who bought what. And those mini shotguns were apparently really popular. A guy said, yeah, a lot of people just carry these in the trunk of their car, you know, in case they get into trouble. You know, there are a lot of guns out there.
Case of road rage.
Yeah, exactly.
These things don't go well on I-5.
But, I mean, part of the criticism of the gun buyback is you're buying back guns that aren't really going to be used anyway. A lot of us, you know, it grew up with guns and have old 22s or whatever in the closet or in the attic and that kind of thing. But I think it's a good program. I think it's great to have that opportunity, especially this sort of no questions asked. You know, you can bring in a rocket launcher or whatever and you're cool. And a lot of people, I mean, there are a lot of guns that were, you know, souvenirs from war. I mean, I remember my grandfather not only had a massive number of guns that he picked up in the fields of France in World War I, we discovered that one of his little displays on the wall actually had live hand grenades. I guess he thought they weren't live, but they turned out
wow.
to be real. But anyway, the sort of little gun market, I agree with Eli. I think it was a great sort of example of both how you can, you know, get a lot of guns sort of out of the system and out of circulation, give people an opportunity to get rid of them or recycle them or whatever. And then on the other side, how easy it is to, you know, that marketplace is. And I agree about the background checks. I think that loophole ought to be closed. And the other one little piece of it, and I was wondering about this when they started the buyback program. Usually those programs are you go in, you get your $100 or whatever it is, and then the guns are destroyed. Well, there are a lot of collectible guns out there. I don't know if you saw a great article in, I think it was the Seattle Times this week, about somebody had donated a fabulously beautiful and valuable Native American vest to the Goodwill, and it's now going to the Burke Museum because it's a real treasure. It doesn't surprise me at all that collectors would gather. Because, you know, people are going to walk in there with, you know, Revolutionary War flintlocks or, you know, all kinds of stuff.
There were more than a share. But it was very odd to watch somebody pull up and roll down the window and a bunch of people run up. And then he pops the hatch and somebody looks at it and he checks the gun, finds the serial number, hands him $100, drives away.
Yeah, but that's the point. That's kind of the point. This also did veer into mayoral politics, if you think about it. You know, Mayor Bloomberg of New York is really active in, you know, mayors to make a difference on this particular topic. And if you're tweet pals with Mayor Mike McGinn, that's not the right phrase, is it?
I think it's very good.
Bad.
Tweet pals.
Well, anyway, whatever that phrase is, McGinn has been tweeting like crazy about...
Part of his flock?
part of his flock that this is a good program, that it yielded this and that, and that that he's coming back with another one. And why not if you're Mayor McGinn? You know, he has, this is a year that he's running. He's using the bully pulpit in that way to say, you know, I'm all about the whole gun buyback. And, you know, you do know that studies show that gun buybacks are not that effective. They're more feel good, but it does, you know, maybe feel good to some people to come in, get rid of a gun that maybe they have, you know, teens in the house or, you know, just any concern about that. But I noticed that Tim Burgess, who's also running for mayor, city council member, sort of didn't want to be left out of this party that's going on for McGinn to be, you know, active and high profile on gun buybacks, again, even if they're not that effective, even if they just sort of drive a message about guns, a city position. And Burgess was, you know, writing on various Facebooks and various other locations, his blog about, you know, how excited he is about the gun buyback, how his views on this survey that came out. And so the mayoral candidates want to be in on this.
Well, what did you make of, well, two facts. One was it was hard to get a number on Saturday about how many guns were collected. And when you pressed the police on, I said, well, you know, really, this is the mayor will make the announcement on Monday. That's when you'll get your hard facts on what numbers there are. But also, I talked to one of the gun buyers in the street. He said, you know, this is just going to create a market for people to steal guns because then they can sell them back. I don't know about that argument, but we also heard an argument from Sir Mix-a-Lot who said they're buying the wrong guns because the guns that people are going to be using are not the guns that were showing up at that buyback. What'd you make of that those arguments?
Well, there's studies that say that a person with a gun in a home is, I think, more likely to be harmed by it than use it in an act of self-defense, right? I hope I've recreated that right, but something along those lines. And so it does do something. Even if it's not getting guns out of the hands of people who are not going to let go of them for $100, it's getting guns out of the hands of people who obviously on some level don't feel comfortable having them. And so therefore maybe are more likely to be harmed by them than find a use for them.
Oh, I thought if nothing else, it showed people how easy it is to sell guns or buy guns on the street. And if nothing else, it keeps the awareness and consciousness. I can't help but think that getting a lot of those guns out of people's homes, we all end up with stuff like batteries or whatever that, you know, you don't know what the way to get rid of it is anymore because you just can't throw it in the garbage. So, I think it's a good service, and it may save some lives. Just making the guns, unused guns just lying around. but you know, Mix-a-Lot is right on the. It's not removing the guns in any significant way that are the sort of heart of the massacre.
Right. Well, we had tragedy here and tragedies in Chicago with guns just this week. Did you hear, are there any voices missing from the hearings that Congress has held, do you think, any of you?
Well, some would argue there were too many voices, just sort of kidding on that, but there was some very rough testimony when folks were sort of unpleasant or unsympathetic to the parents of kids who died in Newtown. That was just very strange to watch. But I was thinking about, that the gun buyback either is or isn't very effective, but maybe it saves one person. And Obama and Biden this week, in a very sort of subtle way, seem to be saying, we don't know if the ideas that we're discussing on gun control, you know, will be sort of scientifically data-driven effective. But they kept saying if it saves one child's life or one person's life. So they started doing a little bit of that too, if you notice that in their the way that both of them were speaking. And the other interesting thing is they're both taking this really kind of interesting political approach. So we all know that Congress has a lot of that their gridlock stuff. And so these folks are going to talk to taking the battle outside D.C. and knowing that they need certain senators and that they need certain representatives, talking to their constituents to bring the pressure that way rather than just staging the gun control fight in Washington.
I personally hate that argument about if it just saves one life. I don't. When you're talking about public policy, I think that's a real lame argument. I mean, you could come up with all kinds of policies that would cost millions of dollars that saved one life, and we would all say that wasn't worth it. The issue is many lives. The issue is making a situation that can be corrosive to the civic structure of a society. I mean, they're larger issues. I also don't buy the argument that because one program doesn't solve the problem, you shouldn't do it. It's like the buyback program. The point isn't that the buyback is going to solve the problem. It's one piece of a bunch of things that you can do, I think, to improve things. And it's one thing a city can do because, you know, it looks like any significant legislation is going to choke in Olympia. It has, and there's no reason to see that particularly changing. And you can already see in the national level, the argument is sinking back into the kind of people ought to be able to own guns and everybody should have a gun. Everybody should own an assault rifle if it saves one single life, it's worth whatever it costs.
It's an interesting frame that everybody's using, isn't it?
Well, and I think it's the way that when you mobilize because of a catastrophe like Newtown, you know, then people slowly begin to sink back into these pre-existing positions, and you know the Senate hearings end up just not really getting you anywhere.
I think what Knut's saying is true. It's partly the art of the possible. So McGinn is doing what he can. He can't change state gun policy, but he can run a buyback program. And Obama and Biden are asking probably for more than they're going to get from Congress. But it does seem like now it's possible in Congress. I'm not sure if it's probable, but it's possible to get this gun show loophole closed, which would be huge. And so if we don't reinstitute the assault weapons ban, which would be good, but we do close the gun show loophole, that's something. And maybe we come back later, probably given our history after another tragedy, hopefully not. But maybe we come back later and, you know, continue to incrementally move toward a more sensible gun policy in this country.
That's Eli Sanders, also Knut Berger, Joni Balter. We're reviewing the news of the week. We'll take a break and return with more stories ahead on Weekday.
Forty-eight degrees in Seattle, still some fog hanging around, and sky is mostly cloudy, although the forecast says it's going to be mostly sunny this afternoon, and we expect to hit 51.
The Super Bowl festivities in New Orleans got off to a rough start when Ravens star linebacker Ray Lewis was accused of using deer antler spray to improve his performance. Lewis angrily denied it, pawed the ground, and then impaled Bob Costas on his horns. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz that obviously is not performance enhanced. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
That's tomorrow morning at 10 right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hubbard Street Dance Chicago, performing two works by Israeli choreographers, February 9th at the Paramount Theater. More information at stgpresents.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:23, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
You're listening to Weekday on KUOW. I'm Steve Scher. We're reviewing the news at the end of the week with Knut Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders. I'm having trouble speaking
today.
I apologize.
Steve Scher. Seems like it works.
Seems like that's my name. Tolls on I-90. The public meetings in Mercer Island and in Bellevue were raucous. The public meeting in Seattle was a little calmer. I heard an argument against the complaint from Mercer Island people that they shouldn't have to pay tolls because of the kinds of tolls they would be charged to pay because, look, you know, because they have to get on, they're trapped on an island.
Yes.
And the argument that Doug McDonald made earlier was, well, people on Vashon Island could make that argument about the ferries, and people in Gig Harbor who have to cross the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, though they have an alternative, they could make that argument. people on ferries in general could make that argument. So Mercer Island people, quit your complaining. Well, I'm adding that.
And get better at your analogies. I mean, the complaint that got the most play was the guy who compared Mercer Island to Alcatraz in the event that there are holes.
That's a problem.
Hey, I've never seen that in the real estate ad.
And it's just
move to a beautiful,
it's absurd,
sunny,
and it completely ignores the history of the situation. Mercer Island would be a lot more like Alcatraz if state money and federal money had not built a bridge to the island in the first place. That's how you get an Alcatraz-like situation. And people from all over the country and state paid for the bridge that makes them feel not like prisoners on their island. And now people all over the state and users of the bridge and people from all over the country in the form of federal money are going to pay to help fix the other bridge that connects the east side to the west side. It makes sense.
No, well,
just hold on a minute. Let's get one more. You're going to say something pro about the tolls before?
No, all I was going to say is this has been building and sort of just sitting there for some period of time. As soon as lawmakers decided they were going to rebuild 520, there were so many different permutations of the tolling for 520 that went on, and the treasurer at the time said that you had to toll both. This was just something he said to make the other tolling work. So now we have some data. We have 15,000 diversions, folks who would use 520 but who are trying to avoid the toll and go on I-90. And so originally this treasurer said that you couldn't even make the bonding work without having both bridges tolled. This has been sitting there, and once there was that shortfall, what is it, $1.4 billion? You know, this was this conversation was going to happen. How it ends up, we'll see. But this conversation was going to happen. It's been, the table has been set for this for many years.
All right, Dr. Treasurer, Dr. Toll, you've been writing about.
Oh boy! Yeah.
You know, I've been telling people that I thought the week ended on Tuesday, and I feel like it has. Dr. Toll, what do you think of what you heard from the citizens?
What do you think of the trolls?
Well, I have some sympathy with their resistance to tolls because of the there are a couple of things. One, the main thing is that, and Eli's exactly right. I mean, you used to have to take a ferry to Mercer Island, so you used to have to pay to get there. When they built the original floating bridge to Mercer Island, you had to pay to get there. It was a toll bridge, but Washington has had a history of limited tolling, which is you pay the toll to pay for the thing you're driving on, and when it's paid for, the toll comes off. It's not and what we've shifted to now is we're thinking of the system more holistically, more connected. You can't pay for all those improvements on the 520 corridor without tolling I-90. Part of it is that you need the revenue, and part of it is you need those people to drive on 520. you need those people who've gotten off of 520, some of them to come back
and clog
it
up.
You can collect all, you know, the full range of tolls on both sides. So the state has committed to building, and I think overbuilding, a new 520 corridor. And to pay for that, the people of Mercer Island are going to have to kick in. And that's, that is just the way it is. And is it a surprise? It shouldn't be.
This is, by the way, a tax just on Mercer Island citizens.
Yes.
The people of Mercer Island will kick in, right, as well as anyone who uses the bridge.
Now, Mercer Islanders have been rewarded in the past, and I think rightly so, for complaining. I mean, they complained vociferously about the new I-90 bridge project, which was not going to be was not going to have a lid on it and would have been really destructive. Now they have a wonderful sort of urbanized downtown on Mercer Island that's not wrecked by a huge gash being drilled through the island. Now, it took money to solve that problem. But it was the complaints of people on Mercer Island that led to that. So there may be some way that out of their tolling upset, that they'll be able to get a piece of the tolling revenue or maybe some improvements or something like that. So from a negotiating standpoint, I think people are genuinely upset. I think the biggest hurdle is coming is people making the jump from the way we used to toll, limited, to the way we are going to be tolling, which is we're going to toll everything.
All right, but what about the benefits of that argument in terms of the system you said that we would take the toll off when it had been paid for? But what we know is things are never paid for. They always need repair. They always need improvement. And a lot more people are using the system. So
that is around the circle.
What do you guys think of that argument?
Well, that is sort of the philosophical debate that's going on throughout the region. And, you know, Mercer Island actually is maybe later to that event than some other areas of the city, because they're talking about tolling the tunnel. They are tolling 520. So this huge debate really is about when do we toll, when do we take it off, and is it like it used to be? We're having that debate because also for 520, when 520 was built, there was a toll on it. When it was finished, when it was paid for, it came off.
Yeah, with a lawsuit.
Yeah, that too. Sure. But the deal is,
because they weren't going to take it off.
Yeah, that's right. They didn't take it off.
Right.
Well, but so when you have a project that's this underfunded, $1.4 billion, and you're trying to build so much new infrastructure all around the region, that is the discussion that's going on. Should we be tolling to sort of make the whole place work, to make the whole place, the population growth, the newcomers? I mean, you could have a whole debate about newcomers coming and creating the need for new infrastructure.
Well, we could charge people who, just like with sewers, if you've only lived here 2 years or less, then you'll have to pay more for the roads than those of us who have lived here longer.
Yeah, see, and that wouldn't fly either. That would never fly. So there is a debate about, you know, can we all get used to tolling? We're building this tunnel. You know, and there's been a huge discussion about whether that sloughs off too many cars onto the downtown streets, that if the tolls are too high there.
Well,
how are the drivers going to respond to that?
Well, go ahead. This is a question of drivers, and this is a question of what do drivers owe to pay for the system they're using, and that's all of us.
Also a question of how to look at the system, and I think Knut put it well. It's whether to view pieces of the system piecemeal or holistically, and it's come to make more sense to view the transportation system and the road system holistically. I don't think it works anymore to solve the transportation problems of this region by just looking at a bridge as a entity unto itself that doesn't connect to anything else or have a financial relationship to anything else.
I come back to you because you've written about this. I mean, isn't this how we're going to have to think about the road? The road is part
yes.
of the city, and the city is part of the region, and we're all using
There are multiple parts of it. One is, how do you pay for transportation in general? And the belief is that the gas tax is limited in terms of how much you can raise it and how long that's going to be an effective way to do it. So they're going to come up with different ways, and Puget Sound Regional Council and the State Department of Transportation, they've all been looking at these new technologies that allow you essentially to toll people per mile whenever you drive. They're looking at toll systems that essentially would toll all major roadways, arterials and highways and that kind of thing. One is to tax people based on just mileage in general, kind of a general tax based on the counting the number of miles that you drive. So that's one of it. The tricky thing is that with tolls is that part of the philosophy is to have the tolls high enough that you discourage people from driving and they move to transit or they move to rail or they just stay home. But you don't piss off enough people that enough still drive to help you pay for your project. So they have to find the sweet spot. They have to find the place that hurts but doesn't hurt too much, and make it easy enough for you to pay these tolls with electronic, you know, transponders and whatnot, that it becomes a kind of invisible tax.
Well, also, one thing that Jay Inslee and this whole will he tax or won't he tax kind of thing, The one thing he and both Rob McKenna had said during the campaign was they were willing to do a transportation tax that would pay for big projects. Now, they didn't mention 520 in that specifically, as far as I recall, but that could be another way. You'll be hearing about that, I bet, this legislative session, as to how, what does that look like? How big is that going to be, and what does it pay for? And maybe, this is possible, the voters will feel that they prefer some kind of a tax rather than a toll. Although, you know, it's funny that this came up first before the big package, because the big package is going to be...
The toll question?
The toll question seemed to come up, whether you should toll I-90 seemed to come up before the grand discussion of what kind of a transportation package would be on the ballot this year or next.
Isn't part of this just strategy on the parts of those who are looking at this question because they want the larger question dealt with and they're using this environmental?
Maybe this is a way to get Mercer Island to vote for the tax.
Well, this is what I was going to say. It would be very interesting if Mercer Island was in favor of taxing the entire state to pay for the bridge improvements across Lake Washington when the vast majority of the state citizens are never going to drive across that bridge, or not very frequently anyway.
But Eli, you know that...
opposed to tolls in their own backyard.
But Eli, you know that any transportation package would not just be about one roadway. It would be about the Oregon-Washington crossing. It would be about 395 in Spokane. There will be other roads that are part of this package.
I know that.
Never sell it that
way. Well, the other part of that is that these road projects are too expensive. I mean, in my personal opinion, we're building... or planning to build, thinking about building too many roads. And I think we need transportation package that's post-freeway, post-highway. Now, that's not...
Well, that's post the way we live, right? You're talking about a different way we arrange ourselves.
I'm talking about saying enough. I'm talking about why aren't we doing a four-lane replacement on 520 instead of a six-lane plus... etc.
So, and then we ask Redmond,
I think,
or Bellevue.
Philosophical disagreements when you get into these issues of how, I mean, it discourages me greatly that the one thing, the one bipartisan thing we can fund in Olympia,
a road project,
is big road projects. It's sick. It's sick. And you know, and so I think tolling is going to make both selling, putting projects in more tempting, but you're going to have to convince the public that those projects are worthwhile if they're going to pay tolls. And I don't think that's been done. That's a long-term. Changing the mindset goes back to your earlier question. Changing the mindset of people, it's happening. It is changing. And I'm sure people who are willing to pay the toll on 520 are really happy right now because it's wide open. But I think changing that mindset is going to be tricky, and I think scaling the projects to something that's reasonable is also something that they have to think about.
And just to return to Joni's point, I do know that you couldn't sell a statewide ballot measure without, or a statewide vote on taxes for transportation without identifying projects that would benefit people all over the state. But that's exactly my point, that projects that are too big for any community to afford on their own are already collectivized in terms of financial responsibility. And to pretend that they're not or haven't been, like the Mercer Island residents who have this fantasy of living on Alcatraz apparently think, is crazy. It's wrong.
Well, I'd just like to say I think tolling sort of destroys that sense of community that you're talking about, because I think it's a libertarian user fee. If you use it, you pay for it. If you don't use it, you don't pay for it, as opposed to promoting a situation of commonweal where we all share in those things. I'm happy. Most of the roads in this state are in eastern Washington. Most of the roads are in eastern Washington. I'm happy to pay for those. I'm happy that's part of it. And I'm happy that, you know, that people and taxpayers in eastern Washington contribute money that we spend on ferry boats that they'll never use. I think that's, you know, I think that's important. So I think you have to handle whatever that financing mechanism is, like per mile charges or whatever, which I think long term, I think those make more sense than tolling specific pieces of road, because then it won't undermine, I think, what you're talking about.
You know, one idea, and it was mentioned in the story, is the idea of just depends on sort of what they charge to. In other words, I've wondered, since there's so much diversion from 520 to I-90, are the tolls on 520 too high? And if you start tolling I-90, is there juggling ability in there to make them both lower because you're increasing the group that's paying the amount? So that is a way, and you know, who said it here, but the idea that maybe Mercer Island's just... I'm sure the feelings are real, but that they will in the end have a better bargaining position for being opposed to this. So maybe that's one of the ways the leverage plays out. It plays out in the actual amount of the toll.
We're going to take a break, and we'll come back. We'll talk about some of the other issues, charter schools, GET, SPIA, and whatever you guys want to bring up. That's ahead on Weekday.
Forty-eight degrees in Seattle, partly to mostly cloudy, still a little bit of fog hanging around. Forecast says mostly sunny this afternoon with a predicted high of 51.
Kevin Spacey says he plays characters that other people like to call villains, but he doesn't.
Villainy is not something you can play. It is a judgment about a character, and I can't judge the characters I play. I can only play them and let the chips fall where they may.
Kevin Spacey. On his new series, House of Cards, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle section of the American Society of Civil Engineers, celebrating 100 years with a tribute to the civil engineers that built Seattle, now on display at SeaTac Airport at Gate B4. More information is online at seattleasce.org.
It's 10:40. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It looks like Google's European Union antitrust case may soon be resolved. We'll have more on that in the news at 11.
You are listening to Weekday, where we review the news of the week in a big nest. We're in at Weekday KUOW, at Jay Balter, and at Eli J. Sanders are all twittering away. A nest. If you're part of a Twitter, you're in a nest. You're a brood or a flock.
So your tweet pals are tweet bees.
Your tweet pals.
Tweet
Tweety birds. Yeah.
Tweety birds. Yeah. And Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knut Berger, and Amy Radel's here with a story. Every once in a while, we get to look at Supreme Court decisions, and you guys were looking at a Supreme Court decision.
And I'm sure this would make people want to ask about our standards for covering a Supreme Court decision, because in this case, it was basically, this was a question that the Supreme Court got from the Ninth Circuit about a case that's been percolating upward about the sheriff's deputy in Clark County. And he drove through a Burger King in 2009, and he was given a Whopper, and he had some suspicions about that Whopper. And he looked at it under the bun, and there was a glob of spit on the Whopper. And
a big, disgusting loogie.
Yeah, yeah. And they had it DNA tested. It was traced to an employee. And this employee ended up being sentenced for felony assault, 90 days in jail.
Yow.
But the deputy is still on a quest for damages for the emotional distress that this caused for him. And that's where it gets into the federal court. He says he has ongoing symptoms of nausea and food aversion and things like that. And so the Ninth Circuit asked the Washington Supreme Court, can you have emotional distress without a physical injury under Washington law? And they brought up some really interesting examples of times when Washington, in the majority of justices, said you can. They gave some examples. One was a woman who was given a family member's ashes, and it wasn't marked. It wasn't in an urn from the crematorium, and she rooted through the ashes of a family member, and she was awarded damages for the emotional distress that could have caused, because she thought it was packing material. So that was one. There were no food cases that they cited, but they cited that one. They cited one where a customer's phone number was printed on a business's sales slips, and that person got harassing phone calls. So not as visceral of a case, but again, they said that person had emotional distress without a physical injury. And they said possibly this deputy has also had that kind of distress. And then the dissenting justices, three justices, said, let's not go down this road. This could, you know, result in endless litigation. It could result in fraudulent, you know, cases coming before the courts. So they said, no, this he doesn't. This deputy was more of a bystander to an incident because he was claiming distress from a burger that he didn't eat. He just saw it. He's like a bystander who maybe witnessed something horrible, but it wasn't that horrible.
Wait, I got a question. So why did he look under the bun?
He was suspicious.
They said the person working in the Burger King had a criminal record. So I don't know exactly, but maybe he saw the person working back there and said, maybe they had some history. I'm not sure.
Whoa, Nelly.
So what's the upshot now? What does he get to do now? He gets the
His lawyer said he's back in business. His case had been dismissed. They had said, you know, we don't think you have grounds for this. And now the Washington Supreme Court opinion kind of gives him some new hope to maybe go back to federal court and get some compensation for his nausea.
Was this a conservative liberal split on the court over this? I can't figure out which way this might have gone.
Yeah, pretty much. It was Justice Gonzalez writing for the majority and then James Johnson writing with the dissent saying, you know, let's not extend our product liability rights any farther.
I got another question. What if somebody put a bug in your food, and it would be hard to tell if the bug got there on his or her own.
These hypotheticals are not entertained by the court.
Okay.
Although they did say the dissenting justices said, yeah, this is going down the road of if a vegan is served something that goes against their diet, if a vegetarian is accidentally served meat, if someone has a hair in their food, again, like you're saying, the bugs, like these things that are kind of more like, well, they do happen. They aren't, you know, completely malicious. And are we going to be compensating everyone who has that kind of experience?
Wow. All right. Burgers for lunch?
Yeah, we can go to In-N-Out Loogie.
Oh.
Maybe now that the court has settled this very important issue, it can turn to the two-thirds majority.
Hey, ba-boom.
Ba-boom. Do not give him an opening.
What does it say about the cop in this case, you know, that he wasn't satisfied with a guy getting a felony conviction out of it?
Well, he was
still not going to Burger King. That was going to change your whole thing.
To say, I think the right wingers on the court were right on this one.
Any last comments?
And I'm sure they'd like to be called right wingers.
Yeah, they love
too.
And we had an outraged email from a listener saying, thanks so much. I was eating my breakfast until I heard this news item. We're sorry if we put anyone off.
I have to say, when Phyllis brought it to our attention, she said, read the Supreme Court decision. And I did. It was too grand.
Can I sue KUW for traumatizing me over this?
Perhaps.
Apparently.
Perhaps you can. That's a terrible idea, and I wish you had not brought it up. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks.
All right. The school levies. Just a question on the school levies. Two levies. Renewals, they do go up, though, for homeowners.
Something like 16%, if that's the right math.
Yes, the first one is less controversial. The second one, which will bring in new schools and build them in different areas. Your thoughts?
You know, I had heard months and months ago, I think we may have mentioned it on this show, that there would be a sort of a big price tag school levy this February. February sort of snuck up on me personally, and I was sort of surprised. Oh my gosh, that's right. That's the $1.25 billion twin package. And as you said, the first one, I believe it's got, is it called Prop 1?
Yes.
Is about a half billion for operating. And Seattle obviously has a huge tradition of supporting those, and as well as a tradition of supporting building levies. But this one is raising some eyebrows among some folks because it sort of redesigns schools so that we have bigger elementary schools to accommodate 500 students and even with the capacity to go to 650. And this is in response to some projections about some student population.
Excuse me.
And, you know, so the question is the one question I think that comes up is that we sort of do trend building and designing. And so now we have on the horizon more students coming. And so we're gonna redesign the schools to be bigger and more efficient is the argument. But a lot of people are going to challenge that. Like in one case, and I forget which school this was, Thornton Creek area, they were going to have one school and then a second school on an outdoor lawn
on their area, field, on their playfield.
On their field that is heavily used for recess. So you're definitely going to have people respond to that.
Well, what do you think of the
go ahead.
What do you think of the argument? Is it fair to take the school district to task for the fact that just a few years ago they closed schools because they had not anticipated the growth. Their growth projections were wrong, and now they are building new schools in short supply. Some arguable the schools were in the wrong place, but they did have to close some schools and sell some schools off. Is it fair to criticize them for that? What do you think, Eli?
Sure. But the way I understood it is that these levies are both extensions or continuations of existing levies.
Yes. So they go up a little bit.
Right.
You pay a little more this time around.
To pay for, I guess, the miscalculation or the needing to...
Or just the more construction. Yeah.
Right. In the sense that these are not new levies and extensions of old levies with a bit more added in to deal with population growth and maybe some errors on the part of the school board. Where have we heard that before? That shouldn't surprise anyone, given our school board's history. I think it makes sense, and the Stranger has endorsed both of these.
Do you think we're the criticism also, Knut, is that we're losing the smaller schools, and therefore neighborhood schools are being closed at a time when we talk about the need for smaller neighborhoods. Some talk about the need for smaller neighborhoods.
Yeah, schools. Well, I hate the trend toward larger schools, particularly larger elementary schools. I like the idea of more smaller schools, and I know that's not necessarily affordable, but I think, the school district has to make some adjustments to where people are living. I mean, school population is increasing. North of the Ship Canal is one area where there are more kids and more students. There's also the whole concept, and I don't know whether this factors into their plans, but there's the whole idea of if you're going to go to a neighborhood school system, you have to have schools in the neighborhoods where people are living or where you can draw people in with that are affordable, etc. So there's a way in which you're always going to be a little ahead or a little behind the curve, and you might be guessing wrong sometimes, and that just kind of goes with the business. I'm also concerned about how recently, though, we were doing school closures and then now doing this thing. It just seems like kind of a whiplash and, wondering whether it makes me wonder about whether their vision for the future is built on a more solid foundation.
I think that's sort of the debate that's going on, that, you know, years just recently you were closing these very kinds of schools. Now you want to open more, and sort of like, who's your demographer and how are you counting this? A bit of that. And don't forget, it's only about a year or two that we had some, you know, overspending, shall we say, by some school officials and new boards. And so the only thing I think that I'm hearing clearly is this sort of from trend to close, trend to build bigger, that there is this sort of, well, it all depends on who's sort of coming up with the capital program. And that does sort of give voters a little bit of whiplash sometimes.
All depends on what bridges we toll.
That'll do it, yeah.
Well, I mean, in that this is about where people are moving, and there are all sorts of trends where people are moving. Part of that is about transportation. It takes
Absolutely.
Us all back. And that's why there's a Puget Sound Regional Council to help us understand these things.
That's correct.
We have, since I mentioned tolling and bridges, I'll just take us back there. They're taking down the ramps to nowhere. Did you ever jump off the ramps to nowhere when you were a
youth? No, I've been on them, but never jumped off.
He was afraid.
Have you ever jumped off them, swum?
I think so, when I was younger.
Yeah. And even I have.
Are they going to be taken down before the summer?
I thought so.
There goes the whole summer.
I don't think they're all going to be down.
Well, jump while you still can,
yeah.
But carefully.
jump, but carefully. What did you? Were you say something on ramps to nowhere?
Yeah, I was going to say something.
Please.
On ramps. Well,
I wrote about it
this week in Crosscut because I think it's really a shame they're taking them all down. And to me, they've grown into this kind of wonderful, you know, Huck Finn kind of people like to sunbathe on them and jump off them. There's moss growing on. They're kind of these cool ruins. But I understand why people, it's hard for people to love unfinished freeway ramps. But to me, they're a great symbol of the sort of Seattle's great Jane Jacobs moment in the 1970s when the freeway builders were about to strangle the city with a ring road expressway system that really would have been devastating to a lot of many, many neighborhoods and whatnot. And the public was originally for it, but environmentalists and neighborhood activists and transit promoters and whatnot were able to get that project, R.H. Thompson Expressway, stopped and eventually the Ring Road system stopped. And to me, you know, people come to Seattle and they see those ramps. There's a great story there. People always say, well, what is that all about? You know, and you get to tell them about the sort of grassroots environmental uprising in the late 60s and early 70s that said no to power, that said no to the prevailing wisdom. And they were right about that. And I think they ought to keep at least one ramp, if not in the Arboretum, then maybe, you know, take one and put it at South Lake Union or something. I think the city needs those kinds of reminders.
Well, what was your example? The 18th century drawings of Piranesi?
Oh, Piranesi, yeah. If anybody's seen those fabulous, Piranesi was obsessed with the ruins of Rome and did these fabulous, you know, drawings. Some of them were imaginary, some of them were real, showing this kind of, you know, sheep grazing in old Roman temples and things like that. It's kind of, and we have a great example. I have a piece coming up on Crosscut about Gasworks Park, which is about to celebrate its 40th birthday, 50th anniversary of the acquisition of the property. It was just named to the National Historic Register. It was a pioneering. People don't realize it. Gasworks Park was the first landscape project in the world that built a park around industrial ruins, and those towers at the refinery there. And they were also one of the very first projects to use bioremediation to do the environmental cleanup out there. It was a very pioneering project, and as it's extremely rare for a project like that to get named to the National Register post-war park, let alone one where the guy who did it is still alive, because that's, they generally don't do that. Rich Haig.
That's pretty cool. Well, they need to, some artists need to paint the ramps to nowhere and capture them.
And run a campaign that says hug an unfinished freeway ramp or something like that.
I want to run with Joni's idea of installing them at Mohai, maybe with a diving pool beneath them, and you wouldn't have to worry about the being careful part
the
of
whole being
using
careful
them,
part.
Which I want to underline for anyone.
Well,
but nonetheless, doesn't the Arboretum folks are pretty glad to see them go.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, they are, and they're going to get a trail. So there's some mitigation, whatnot. But they're not being treated. I mean, you know, WashDOT is not the kind of organization, and most transportation departments think if you build a new bridge, you tear the old one down. You know, they have trouble. They don't want to preserve historic bridges generally. They don't want, you know, and they view, I'm sure they view those ramps as an embarrassment and a mistake from the past, and they get to correct it. And my thing is, yes, they are an embarrassment and mistake. That's why we need to keep them. We need to remember.
We should remember that part of the reason they're being removed is because there is a new freeway coming.
There is a road coming. They may not
fit.
That
is the sad irony is that it's a bigger freeway coming through now. And the Ring Road system that was opposed has been kind of slowly being recreated in bits and pieces. So
we'll have 605 in no time going through Snoqualmie Valley.
There you go.
All right. I just leave you on this. UW did a housework study. Common perception is that couples have sex more when they divide up household obligations evenly. But a new study from the UW says that couples with traditional divisions of chores, wherein a man does yard work and a woman cleans and cooks, have more sex.
I'm just going to leave it right there.
And also, in the interview that Katie Sewell did, the researcher said that same-sex couples found that male partners divide chores logically, meaning that the one who made the most money did less chores. And they also found that men covered for each other more, not letting outsiders know that one person mainly took care of the house.
Now, why is it more logical? This is what I've for the person who makes more money to do fewer chores, because the way I see it, the way our culture rewards money to people for different jobs is not supremely logical in the first place.
They should do no chores.
There are people who make a lot of money for non-taxing jobs, is what I'm saying, and have energy to come home and do a little more work.
That is logical.
Boyfriend here.
No, you're not.
That's a very, very taxing job.
I want to know what kind of sex life people who have servants have.
They don't have sex life at all.
They have no sex? They have nothing but sex.
Well, do you watch the Downton Abbey? All right. I'm leaving it there. Because this has been a long week, and I have to go do some chores.
I hope they're manly chores.
I hope they're logical chores.
Kit Berger is editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine and writes the Moss Spec column at crosscut.com. Eli J. Sanders is his Twitter handle, and he's associate editor of The Stranger, and at J. Balter is her Twitter handle as assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. We'll all flock away together. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Asade, Andy Hurst, and Bernard Ouellette is the engineer and your host for the rest of this morning and much of the afternoon. I will bring you a burger later.
Thank you, Steve.
That's not nice.
Oh, what an insult.
No, that does sound a little harsh. I meant that more kindly than that. I'll bring you something else.
I'll DNA test it either question.
I'll DNA test it, right?
It's 10:59. The latest jobs report is in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Village Theater, presenting The Mousetrap, now through February 24th. 8 inhabitants, 1 murderer, and 1 nameless target make up this Agatha Christie murder mystery, now celebrating its 60th year. Tickets at villagetheater.org.
When Jennifer was 3, she lived in an all-black neighborhood in Milwaukee. One day she was riding her tricycle and saw an older white couple sitting on a bench.
Because I had never seen white people, I assumed that they were ghosts. So I waved, and I remember hearing, I thought, wow, that must be the way they talk.
Kid Logic, true stories, this week on This American Life.
That's tomorrow morning at 11, right here on KUOW.
This is Guy Raz, the host of Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.